Hello and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. I'm your host, David Bahnsen. Very excited to be the host of this great endeavor from National Review, committed to the defense of free enterprise, the defense of capital markets. There are very few things I enjoy doing each week more than hosting this podcast. One of the reasons is the great guest I get to interview, some of which are heroes of mine, some of which are friends of mine, some of which are heroes and friends of mine. And oftentimes I get to meet some new people. Our guest today, I have been doing Larry Kudlow's show with him for quite some time. Jim Iorio, the managing director at TJM Institutional Services. Jim is on CNBC all the time. He's on Fox all the time. You can follow him on Twitter. He's a well-known trader, particularly in the options and futures market. Has a great understanding of macroeconomic themes. He himself, you know, lives more in the technical side of markets. I live more in the fundamental side. But, he just has a great perspective on things, really understands capital markets. And by the way, owns a restaurant in Chicago we're going to talk about a little today. Gives him a great feel for the just kind of Main Street, you know, side of the economy as well, that maybe sometimes us financiers might lose sight of. So I'm excited to just have a conversation with Jim and let you all benefit from the way in which we converse about markets and the economy and all the things that are so important in this point of history we live in. So with that, let me bring Jim into the Capitol Record. So with that said, welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record and another 2022 guest who is joining us for the very first time, Jim Iorio. Welcome to Capitol Record.
Thank you for having me, David.
So Jim, I think you and I started doing Larry's radio show together right when he got back from the White House. We've been on quite a few times over the last year or so, and I know you probably see me on his Fox TV show, and I see you on his Fox TV show. So we at least, if nothing else, share in common a friend in Larry Kudlow, but I have a feeling we share much more in common. Why don't you tell National Review a bit about yourself, your background?
So I've been a trader broker for 35 years. I started out right out of college with Goldman Sachs in 1987. And I started in there in foreign currencies, and I moved to interest rates along the way. Dealt with clients about 15 years ago. I started trading my own money alongside brokering for clients, and now I'm down to like probably just three or four actual active clients, big hedge funds, and then my own stuff during the day. I mostly trade futures, mostly trade equity indexes, interest rate products, and FX and commodities as well. So whatever seems to be moving, if I can, you know, you and I both being in the media too, we get to have a lot of really smart people on our Rolodexes. And occasionally I'll hear someone I really respect talk about a market, and then I'll spend the next couple of months trading that market. But I'll trade whatever's moving. And that's pretty much it. I live in Chicago. I own a restaurant. And I will plug that several times. If you guys can't see, I'm wearing the brand's t-shirt here. So I try to take time to plug it every time.
Yeah, so Larry likes to use how your restaurants are doing as maybe a bellwether for food and beverage, hospitality, leisure, travel, various aspects of that service economy that got beat up during COVID. How did you guys handle the restaurant deal in the People's Republic of Chicago during COVID?
So my restaurant is not a good example of how the restaurant industry is doing. My partner and I at the restaurant have a pretty good glimpse because of the network we've created within the restaurant business. And the reason ours is an old school pub that's been there since 1931. It's been busy as heck the entire time. The only reason we got it for a steal almost 10 years ago was for some nefarious reasons from the other owners. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that what we sell is normalcy. We sell, you come into our place, it could be 1960. The decor hasn't changed and nobody wants it to. So our restaurant has done great. Our friends in the restaurant business are not seeing the same thing. Like the restaurant business supplies have gone up between 20 and 25%. Labor costs have gone up. In the People's Republic of Chicago and Cook County, they've raised minimum wage twice in the last 15 months. after shutting down these small businesses. So it's the most absurd thing. You know, I believe our mutual friend Carol Roth wrote the book, The War on Small Business. And when you see it play out like this, where they really just keep tightening the screws to you, it blows me away. Now, that being said, my restaurant's still doing fine. The weirder things get and the worse other restaurant gets, it seemed like people flocked to our place more because they've been going there their whole lives and they want to harken back to a simpler time, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, and it's funny, as you describe your restaurant, I don't drink anymore like our friend Larry, but I really like old school restaurants like that, and they seem to be going away in most places, this kind of old school ambiance and environment. Now, New York City, where I spend half my time, still has plenty. And those are the kinds of places I like to eat. But I notice every restaurant that closes here in Newport Beach, California, it gets replaced with a very modern, kind of healthy, kind of, I don't know, just all the things I don't really want.
Amen, brother. Just ridiculous. And I was saying, there's people who eat at Brandt's 3 or 4 nights a week. Brandt's is the name of the restaurant. And I tell them, if you keep eating at our place, you're going to die, but it's a hell of a way to go. You know what I mean? Yeah. You'll have a smile on your face. It's kind of a joke. I hope they don't, and I hope they get some exercise too. But it's an old school pub. But I understand it's a 135-year-old building. So, you know, upkeep on it is expensive. But the more others go away, the more valuable ours become, I think.
Do you know New York City much?
I know it a bit. Yeah, I've been.
Do you know a place in New York that'd be comparable to your pub?
Not that I can think of.
I bet like a PJ. It sounds like a PJ Clark's. There's an old brick building on 3rd Avenue, and it's been there since the 19th century. And now you have all these modern skyscrapers around it, but they've kept the building down there. And so it's just one of these really old school kind of pubs. There's several downtown, actually down by Wall Street.
Yeah, I know the place you're talking about. I've actually been there, and I think that that's a really good comparison. Now throw in a Al Capone history with ours. You know, he controlled it. His gang controlled it until like 1933. He was already gone. And that's when another gangster took it over. And so it's, you know, throw in that because that's kind of the Chicago flair, which a lot of people really love that as well.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. By the way, The Untouchables remains my favorite movie of all time. I can quote it from start to finish.
Okay. My restaurant plays into that. So you ready or no?
Yeah. Let me hear it.
You know the scene where Capone, played by De Niro, kills the guy with the bat, right?
I don't know. I've only acted it out 1,000 times.
Hey, I don't remember that scene. Right, but anyway.
Teamwork.
He says, so the real story on that, it was in Roger Tooey's book, The Guy Who Owned Brandt's. So we made better beer out here in the northwest suburbs than they did in the city. So Capone used to send his guys out here. He was trying to shake down Roger Tooey and take over the beer making business out here. But the one time he was getting more and more frustrated, and he sent two young kids out to shake him down and come up with a deal where he'd buy it. And instead of doing that, they just drank good beer at either my pub or one of the other pubs around here. Roger Tooey owned like 4 of them out here. And then when they came back to the city having failed in their task is when Capone killed the guy with a bat. And that was in Roger Tooey's book, explained it. It was pretty wild.
So you have a connection to one of the great gangster movie scenes of all time.
Absolutely. And I think about the line in that movie, you know, we do not approve of your methods. Well, you're not from Chicago. Yeah. So you and I are on the same page.
Yeah. A lot of great love of Chicago in the movie. So in terms of before we get more into markets and whatnot, this COVID thing, and you said, oh, your restaurant's a bit different. You mentioned labor prices have come up. Supply prices are higher. And I wonder if you think the minimum wage laws are a large part of it, or it has more to do with the stimulus of the COVID moment and the extended federal supplement to unemployment? Or is your belief that it's kind of all of the above, that there's been a real perfect storm of upward wage pressures and downward supply pressures in terms of getting people to work, all of which has just crushed that segment of the economy?
So, yes, the answer to the all-the-above question, I think, is absolute. Now, the minimum wage part of it is interesting, and I don't think people realize the ramifications. Local, small restaurants, the kind we're talking about, not the big chains, like to hire high school kids for two reasons. They're cheaper, But also, they get you kind of entrenched in the community. You know, you hire a few kids from the high school. Their parents come in. They tell people. So that's the model. And the kids, whether they make $8 an hour, $9 an hour, $12 an hour, end up being the beneficiary of that because they gain work skills. I've seen kids come into our restaurant who didn't even know how to look adult in the eye and speak to them and left being able to solve problems, bang, bang, bang. So that part is going to go away because of the minimum wage. But any like real breadwinners, I don't think the minimum wage makes a difference because I think most of the people are paid a lot higher than that. But I think it's when you mentioned eviction moratoriums, stimulus, increases in unemployment benefits, loan forbearance, all that crap. But then you throw in that for 2 years, the asset prices, including the equity markets, were doing nothing but going ahead and then going straight up. And then according to Joe Brussels, I don't know if you know Joe, he's the chief economist for RSM, he did a thing about how 3.25 million baby boomers prematurely left the workforce. Now, maybe that's because COVID and COVID mitigation just shook them up so bad and they think, well, there's got to be a better way. Or maybe it was because of really enthusiastic future projections of what their assets and what their retirement plan is going to do, which gave them the confidence to do that. So I think there's about five or six different things that all affected this labor thing. Do you agree with that?
I do. And so then now if you look at it this way, and I wrote economic commentary on this last week, if we are 1.2 million less people in the labor force, and yet the unemployment rate is now back to the same 3.6% pre-COVID, you could say, okay, well, the labor participation force dropped by that much. There's 1.2 million people that decide not to work anymore. But that ignores trend line going back to 19. We really had 3.5 million people net leave the workforce. We ought to have 3.5 million more workers than we do right now. 2.3 on top of the 1.2 we've lost. And across those 3.5, it now appears very clear to me that there is a distribution of loss from boomers who left the workforce early, and the like 19 to 26 year old area where young adults who should be in the workforce full time and aren't, and then there's a middle ground as well, and people that are quitting. I think the data there in that middle ground, maybe they're trying to do a startup and it's not showing up in the labor data. I don't. Maybe they're doing some kind of underground economy work that doesn't reflect. But what I believe is actually the most pessimistic of all theories, which is that we have a bad reason for older people leaving and a bad reason for younger people leaving, and they're different reasons. And so if there are 57-year-olds who thought they wouldn't hit their number until they were 62, and then they think they hit their number at 58, and so they leave early, that is very dangerous to the idea of a flourishing retirement, one little shock and awe in markets. Look, we saw this. I'm sure you were trading then, but as I was sort of entering the business in the late 90s, early 2000s, it's what made me a religious dividend growth investor, was I saw people that were trying to withdraw from a negatively compounding portfolio. And that even as the S&P went up 100% from late 02 to late 06, it was doing so with such a diminished capital base that there were retirees who were only withdrawing 3-4% of money. But if they started in 2000, they were out of money.
Yeah. Scary and sad.
It's very scary, and it's math.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. And that's terrible. And then there's a part of a psychological thing, too, that obviously I can't put a finger on and nobody else can either. And that's perhaps a large part of the population that just got punched in the face by this whole COVID and mitigation and made a decision that different things were more important to them. And I'm talking now about the younger group, too. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, work less. I don't know how they're going to live, but maybe they're figuring out maybe it's back to the hippie days. And they're going to live in communes or something. I don't know.
So different things more important to them than work, than eating, than...
It seems that way. If the government's going to feed them, I don't know. Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, maybe you're right. I don't know. I said I don't know this. It's just...
I don't either. My little theory, I think you and I talked about this once. I think primarily most of the things that happened in the economy during COVID that people think are going to stick a bit, not stuff that was related to the immediacy of lockdowns or whatnot, were trends already in play. So people talk about people going to the suburbs. Look, Phoenix and Miami were really hot, or like Naples and Tampa. They were very hot housing markets before COVID. And they got hotter and all that stuff. But I think there's a lot of demographic things and so forth that were in place before. And America's kind of declining interest in work was really started the financial crisis.
No doubt about it.
Participation force only had 1 year of noticeable increase. And that was Trump's, I think, second year in office, which was the same year, by the way, that we got the only time basically a three handle on real GDP growth. For the most part, from 08 till now, and this is one of my big arguments about deflationary pressures that I still think exist in the economy in the midst of a current inflationary cycle, but the secular story has been less kids per household since financial crisis, less real GDP growth, about half of trend line. And the issue you're bringing up, there seems to be people that are a little less interested in work and want something different in their life. And I don't know where it all comes from, but it sure seems to me to be more of a cultural problem than anything else.
Yeah, and it was definitely exacerbated over the last 2 years. And I have two daughters who are, one's 28, one's 25. And both of them are relatively high achievers and work pretty hard. But just talking to their friends, it's like you and I were, when we were that age, we were going to catch the tiger. We were going to get out there and we'd work 60 hours, but they don't make decisions that way anymore. Even my own daughter, who's hardworking as heck, was offered two jobs, and one was a really high paying consulting job, flying all around the world, making, lots of money. And she took a different job, a great job, but 40, 45 hours a week. And she just loves it and talks about how great a decision it was. You and I would have taken the other job. I took Goldman Sachs. I worked 60 hours a week. I was willing to laugh with my coworkers, but slit their throat to get ahead of them. And I'm not necessarily proud of that. But it was. I grew up in a house with 11 people, an immigrant household, headed by an off-the-boat Italian, and I was not going to be poor. And I'm glad that I had that attitude, even though drove me to...
When I hear you working at Goldman Sachs starting off at 60 hours a week, I didn't know they used to hire part time.
Nice one.
Yeah. Listen, I love the story. I love the DNA you're describing. We're very like minded on this front. But let's putting aside our own kind of frustrations with the culture and concerns of where things may be, this stuff does tend to ebb and flow. I'm not one. It's one of my reasons for my love and affection for Larry Kudlow. I'm optimistic about the DNA. I don't think the entrepreneurial spirit of America has been removed, but there's a problem with a certain segment, and we have to address it. But when you look right now at the economy, what sticks out to you most as a red flag? Are you thinking we're going to be dealing with a secular inflation story for a while? Is that the biggest issue, or is it something else on your radar?
Whether or not it's secular, whether or not it's going to be something we're worried about in 2 years, I'm not sure matters right now. I think that it's not going away on its own. And I think that those politically motivated half-wits at the Fed a year ago easily, and we've talked about this as well, and I'm sorry if some of your friends, I know some of those guys too, and they seem like great people, but a year ago, the fact that they were stimulated economy, when they could see the storm clouds gathering as far as supply chain goes, and they could understand that there was other things affecting inflation, and yet they still did their part to move along inflation, buying $40 billion a month of mortgage backs into the teeth of an absolutely red hot housing market, then buying 80,000 of the rest of the bonds when it was clear that things were starting to move. I don't know if you saw the woman from the IMF, I can't remember her name, an economist, and she talked about all the unintended consequences. And I'm screaming at the TV going, these were not unintended consequences. These were absolutely intended. I'll give you 15 different examples of Fed officials over the last 10 years looking straight at the camera and saying, we need inflation. And you and I know why they needed inflation. There was at least five states that whose debt obligations were absolutely unsustainable, and then you throw in their pension obligations, the only thing that could have possibly saved them was throwing an extra 40% of the money supply in, deflating the dollar, and trying to make it back on the back end with taxes. And it could work. It just doesn't seem likely that we're going to get a soft landing. I think they're going to knock us into a recession. Now I think Colin Roach, I don't know if you talked to him or follow him on Twitter at all, just was reading a thing of his today, is that it always seems like the Fed is just playing catch up. And they were playing catch up a year ago, and now I worry about they've tightened a quarter point. I still think they should go ahead with their tightening, but I think the worry now is breaking something and pushing us into the next inflation, which that's where my money is going to happen towards the end of this.
Into the next recession, you mean?
That's what I meant, the next recession. Yeah. And I know if your point is going to come back to me saying that, you know, the labor market is hot as hell, how's there going to be a recession? Well, that's got to cool off, obviously. That's why I don't think it's for another 6 months.
And so this becomes a boom-bust cycle exacerbation that is exactly what we've been in for a few decades now, right?
An asset
bubble. Things get too hot. They take steps. They contract a bit. And each recession looks and feels a bit different. But really, the Fed has their hands in a highly discretionary and intervening sense, both in trying to heat up and cool down the economy. For the life of me, I'm trying to understand why the American economy, 330 million people, producers and consumers, relatively speaking, a very educated workforce, high amount of technology prowess, incredible capital markets, the world's greatest capital markets we've ever seen.
No doubt.
Why the hell do we need a central bank to heat up and cool down an economy? Why can't an economy do it on its own?
And I'll take that a step further, too. Over the last, let's call it 40 years since the 80s, the existence of that central bank has become a crutch that the federal government uses because they are afraid of a normal run-of-the-mill garden variety recession. So they keep pushing those away until it explodes into something much, much worse, which we've seen two, possibly three times if we're counting what's happening now. I think it's absurd that they think they need to control this. And, you know, I'll just...
So does the Fed think that... There's a chicken or egg thing I want to unpack with you. Do you think the government is expecting the Fed to do it? Or is the Fed doing it and the government's allowing it? Like, who's driving that? And then I'd add a third component. Is it really just the government anymore? Or does Main Street want the Fed on that wall?
So if something breaks, recessions happen, these politicians are worried about getting voted out, so these politicians are putting pressure on the Fed. Because remember, we pretend that the Fed is some autonomous organization, but they get appointed by the government and they work for the government, they need to be approved. So the notion that they're independent is ridiculous. So let's just, for this discussion, say that they're basically the same as the government. That's the way I look at it too. But yeah, I think that these... In the words of Mel Brooks, we got to protect our phony baloney jobs here. And that's what the government, I think, tends to believe. And the Fed, they will appoint people who will carry out what they need to boost the economy. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, but I think what I'm saying is kind of critical of other actors that I disagree with from Greenspan on. I believe that each of the Fed heads, from Greenspan to Bernanke to Yellen to Powell, has done things that I vehemently disagree with. Some perhaps more than others, some with rhetoric that bothers me more than others, but all of which I think entailed a certain belief, a sincerely held belief, that they A, could, and B, should be arbiters of the business cycle and manage some degree of economic stability. And I think that there is an arrogance in that and a hubris that is problematic. But I also believe that what has happened is Powell inherited an environment where he doesn't believe it. Everybody believes it. And so now when the blank hits the fan, what are they saying on TV? Oh, what's the Fed going to do? What are people saying on their couches, in their living rooms, offices? Now, I understand that there's a kind of component of the middle class that would not even know what I'm talking about, wouldn't agree that they are consciously self-aware about looking for the Fed. But I guess I'm saying that there is a professional class and a media that has more or less made the Fed the default. And the Greenspan celebrity era is a big part of this. Bernanke felt the need, and I think he may have been right from a PR standpoint. He did a big 60 Minutes thing in the midst of the financial crisis. But if you go back, Jim, you remember this. March of 2020, who did we see more on the news? Mnuchin or Powell?
Powell.
I think it was Powell.
Me too. And that's, so it's like the whole White Knight syndrome. You know, once they've become this kind of level of folk hero, they believe themselves. And I don't even fault them for that. Everybody's just a human. When everybody tells you that it's your job to ride in and save things and you have the power. And I remember when Greenspan was in power saying, hey, this is the most powerful man in America. And I remember thinking, this is probably not a good thing. I think most people, aside from people like you and I, should maybe even not be able to name who the head of the Fed is off the top of their head. And that's just not the case. I think it's absolutely right what you're saying. And I know, so to put a fine point on it, I think what we're saying is that they get this position, which probably shouldn't even be there. Lender should meet borrower, and that's what should set interest rates. I think they have fostered this era of regulation, punitive taxes, that now our economy at multiple different levels needs rates held inorganically low to prosper. And then when that builds up over time, and you know, distorts the risk-taking curve, we see these big implosions that we've seen several times in our career. That's kind of what we're saying, right?
Absolutely. And then I think that there is a negative feedback loop that comes out of it, a la Japan, where you need more financial repression to deal with the hangover of the financial repression that they created. And so you get a kind of downward pressure on growth because the Fed is helping keep companies alive that are shouldn't stay alive. And they represent a suboptimal part of the economy. So resources, both human talent and capital, go into an area of the economy that they otherwise wouldn't go to if humans were more freely acting. And I don't mean that they're acting against their will. I mean that optics are distorted, price discovery is distorted, and so forth. So it's a very Hayekian interpretation of what the Fed's doing. And what it does is it puts me in a weird position because I want to be a Fed critic, but I'm not criticizing that, oh, the Fed funds rate should be this instead of this. Candidly, a lot of the hard money guys have been more wrong than the Keynesians about what the money rate was supposed to be. And your point is lenders and borrowers can figure that out, and I agree. But I don't have a problem with there being a Fed, a lender last resort. But I do have a problem with the Fed head being a celebrity. I think it's a backroom person, and that they're effectively really there in not much different of a position than what J.P. Morgan would have been there like in the late 19th century, early 20th century, only with the real ability in concert with Treasury to drive more liquidity in the economy when it needs it. I think they're basically there to help us avoid deflation on a supreme scale.
Sure, and to take the sharpest edges off a recession if it looks like it's going to be anything more than just a hedge trimming. And they don't do that. They became an activist Fed because of the celebrity. And that's easy. You tell me that I'm a celebrity and that my every move is important, and I'll believe that in about a week. It's the easiest thing to sell to someone on the planet, is that you're the guy who's pulling the strings. So you're the maestro. Yeah. And for those of you in the audience who don't remember that, that's what they called Greenspan. That was the name of his book, right? Before everything hit the fan.
Yeah, it's interesting because they would talk about like guys like Jim Grant, who I've had on this podcast, who I respect a great deal.
Really? I love Jim Grant.
Jim Grant. There's a lot of folks that are critical of what they call the PhD class at the Fed, and they're worried about them being so disconnected from the real world that their economic models and Ivy League faculty lounge kind of biases are really given too much power in the administration of monetary policy. I don't disagree with that criticism at all. But I would actually argue that the desire for a Fed chair to be popular is even more dangerous.
Amen.
And I think that really that's what you've seen. I recall like it was yesterday, the early 2016 dot plots. This is one of the reasons I have PTSD about believing the Fed. Right now, guys like Jim Bianco and others I like, I think you're in this camp, are saying, hey, the Fed could end up tightening more than we think, and the market's not ready for it. But I'll tell you, you went through those 2012 to 2019 years, it's hard to take the Fed seriously, hawkish, because they didn't follow through on anything.
You remember August of 2017, I think it was the stock market broke 8% after they tightened. James Bullock, he had just given a speech.
It was 2018.
He'd just given a speech like 3 days earlier talking about tightening. The only thing that changed was the 8% crack in the stock market. He said the case for tightening is less compelling. I remember, what the hell are you talking about? The only thing that's changed is the stock market's giving a little back.
And I remember Janet Yellen in January 16, they had 4 rate hikes to go on the dot plot. They did the very first rate hike in December of 15. It was 25 basis points off of zero, where it had been for 7 years. So you ever watched a basketball game where like one team can't score for like the first 4 minutes and it's really awkward, and then they make like a free throw or one basket and it's like 17-2? And it's almost like worse than 17-0, you know, just this one little thing lingering there. It sort of highlights like how obnoxious what's going on is. They did one rate hike, and Yellen came out and said, well, if you remember, the S&P's dropped a lot January 16, but at the time it was the worst January in the history of the market. But China was significantly devaluing. And it was having a pretty big impact on what was happening with their Forex reserves and so forth. And Yellen said, we have to look to the impact on emerging markets. And I was an emerging market investor. I appreciated her looking out for me. But I thought, what the hell kind of triple mandate is this?
Yeah, take care of your own house first.
The emerging markets is now one of the most risky of risk assets is a consideration. I know she was talking about dollar surplus and other bank reserves and things. You know, there could be a contagion effect. I get all that. But fundamentally, the problem is that they're in that position to begin with, that they could have that kind of impact. And so this is what I mean by me being in a tough position. I am a Fed critic who believes that we're sometimes criticizing the Fed for the wrong reason. That MBS purchase, $40 billion a month throughout all of last year, was just inane. Yeah. But candidly, I think the largest problem we have in the housing market is supply-oriented, that we simply do not, especially in big blue states that are highly regulatory and this and that, we're not making enough housing stock. And I think that the Fed trying to control the cost of capital was just a silly add-on to the problem. And yet right now they're going to stop buying MBS. They're going to allow MBS to roll off. But how long is it going to be till we really get housing to cool? I think you're going to have to see the supply-demand balance come back. And those things are outside the Fed's control. And you know who would not take me quasi-defending the Fed here? Is the Fed. Because they don't want to admit that they don't have the control over the things we're talking about. And that's a really interesting component of what we're dealing with here.
I love the way you put it too. And particularly the housing market, I think, is real. Because I agree with you 100% that supply over, you know, since the Great Recession hasn't kept up. We have to throw in the fact that I believe it's about 1/5 of the housing stock over the last 2 years was bought by hedge funds, particularly yours and my friend BlackRock. So what we've created here is kind of an insane world where young people can't buy houses because they've gone up too much because BlackRock's buying up front of them. Now, that being said, we're talking to everybody of our era thinks, oh, the housing market could turn around. Well, I don't think what's going to happen is just going, the housing market's just going to slow down. The day I see my brother-in-law, who's an electrician, talk about having 5 homes that he's rehabbing and flipping, and I don't see that. I see plenty of people with 2 homes. I've personally been a real estate investor. I'm considering selling a couple right now, but I don't think there's going to be any sort of big implosion in housing because I don't think there's the type of leverage, the mom and pop leverage, that extended itself into 2007. Do you agree with that?
Totally agree. It's not even in the same stratosphere. And so again, this tendency to want to always think, like a lot of the inflation hawks right now that are saying, oh, it's the 1970s again. You know, people saying to me, no one says, Dave, do you think housing's overpriced? They say, do you think we're going to have another 2008?
Right.
And sometimes there can be a rhyme, but not a repeat. And I would argue exactly what you just said. I think housing is frothy and in need of correction. And in some places, that'll be 8 to 12%. And in some places, it'll be 15 to 20%. But it's not a 50 to 70% implosion because the credit environment is simply nowhere near the bubblicious state of 08. And the equity extraction has not been what it was building up to 08. We still have significant protective equity in homes. The only thing I would say is I don't think we've learned our lesson about viewing one's primary residence as an asset or an asset class. That needs to stop. It's a place for people to live, raise their family, have their dreams come true, play some backyard basketball, grow a garden, all the things you do to make your life fulfilling. But this notion that, no, the value of the home is my asset, first of all, they can't monetize it unless they sell it. And if they sell it, they either have to be homeless or go buy high somewhere else. It's just, the thing I always say about 1031 exchanges. I've never understood the benefit of selling high so I can buy high at the exact same time.
I just was coaching my brother through the same thing today. He wants to sell his big house because he's alone now and buy this other house. But I'm trying to explain to him that the mortgage he has now, it's 3.25. He's swapping for a mortgage that's 5.25. He's going into a townhouse that has these HOA. And he's a counselor at a school. He's a bright guy. But sometimes people just don't get that. It doesn't make sense for him financially to sell his house. And I had to walk him through every step of it just today.
Well, sounds like we're on the same page there. So what's your take, Jim, with the Biden administration? Do you think that the markets will respond to a Republican takeover of the House? Is it already too priced in to matter? Do we just get gridlocked for the last 2 years of his presidency, and then markets have to kind of wait to 2024 to see what a new growth agenda looks like? Am I underthinking the no, political?
No, I think that if Republicans take the House and gridlock, you know, I love gridlock. I vote for politicians if I think they're going to be particularly feckless and won't be able to get anything done. I hate when these people are like, well, yeah, they can't get anything done. Yeah, no, I want them to not get anything done. Every time they get something done, they end up messing it up. Yeah. So I think the markets are going to like coming into this election and believing there's going to be a more business-friendly group of politicians being ushered in. But I think that that's a far, far second place factor right now than just stock markets. And I've been saying this for months now, that we have to get used to a new rate environment. I mean, you know, Greenspan's favorite way to look at the stock markets, and one that I like too, is earnings yield compared to like investable treasury yield. Well, that's got to rewrite itself now. I mean, interest rates are higher. And so the same multiples that we looked at before don't make sense. I think I've taken these words right out of your mouth when we were on Larry's show, but I believed that the S&P was going to trade down 20%, the NASDAQ was going to trade down 35%. I've been shorted, and again, for anyone who follows me on Twitter and knows my trading style, the last couple months, I've been able to effectively turn a great trade into a pretty good trade, which is kind of this skill that I have when I overcook it. But I don't believe that the stock market's going higher until we get a good picture of where rates stabilize.
And along the way, are you comfortable with this concept of, so basically I agree with everything you just said, and that would be one of my critiques of indexing in this environment, but I wouldn't apply what you said to some active fundamental, you know, less trade sensitive and more long-term wealth creation out of dividend growth. You know, particularly the energy sector has been very good. We think consumer staples right now, it's interesting. We're only about a quarter of the way in earnings season. And yet all of the good results have been companies that said, yeah, input prices were way up, but we raised prices more. and all the companies that had disappointments, it was for the lack of pricing power. And so it does seem to me that there is kind of a Darwinian high dispersion of result coming in the market. My theme for a while, and I was early calling it, but I'm liking how right we've been right now. You know how it is. You always feel good.
Yeah.
I think it's more like the year 2000 and then a full re-rating, where people forget when the NASDAQ was down 70% that the Dow was up that year.
Right.
And it wasn't until 9/11 that the Dow actually ended up going negative. So in that kind of 2.5 year bear market, really, it was very secluded to NASDAQ names, with value and the Dow doing quite well for a while. We're up on the year with no shorts, no hedges. It's just long only. But energy has cheated a lot of that because we're so overweight there. But then you look at the stuff that's gotten murdered, and most people are doing okay this year. It's been about what they didn't own versus what they did own.
Right. And I agree with you completely. And I think the another parallel to the 2000 thing is that the most froth was built up in the tech sector. Tech sector, you know, trades off of rates more than anything else. It was the perfect storm for tech to get hammered. You saw what happened at the close today, I'm sure. Well, of course you did. But that's where I'm short the most, was in the NASDAQ. And I think it just looks awful to me. The things that I have liked, and this was about a year and 4 months ago, at the beginning of last year, which was 2001, that my thing was crude. Remember, before that, oil had been just hammered before that. So I've been in crude names since then, and it turned out being an absolutely great trade. I've taken a third of it off, as I've posted on Twitter, but I'm still in two-thirds of it, and I still think crude, and I still think miners. I still think gold. Gold respected that 1900 level, and if you want me to make a fundamental case for it, I'll say that if everything else is getting hammered, not most everything, and you just said there's obviously some things that aren't. And by the way, I applaud the fact that you are up this year. That's fabulous. I think that we have to say that at least two more times. But I think that that gold maybe just as a hideout. If Bitcoin is trading along with stocks, particularly of tech stocks, and that's getting hammered, people are going to look for someplace to go. And that's why I think gold has respected that 1900 level. And that's where I want to be right now.
So, Jim, why has gold not done better for the last 10 years? It would be hard to imagine central banks being more reckless and experimental than they've been. And of course, for the last 16 months, people even got the inflation numbers that gold bugs have always worried about. You're right, it's turned up. It's got good technical backdrop right now. I assume you probably like it more as a trade. But is gold not the inflation hedge we used to think it was in the late 70s?
Well, no. Gold is like a chameleon. It changes all the time what it is. Sometimes it's a safe haven. Sometimes it's a dollar hedge. Sometimes it's an inflation hedge. But one thing that should be pointed out is that over the last 10 years, let's say over the last 5 years, part of the story is gold's total market cap is what? About 10 what's gold's total market cap? I just had it in my head a second ago. Not 10 trillion, just $10 billion, right? Could gold markets cap? But anyway.
Oh, you're talking about including central bank reserves?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to do the comparison of gold versus cryptocurrency. And I remember at one point, So it's 200 billion to 300 billion crypto was out of, the trillion-dollar gold market. That's what I was trying to do. I was messing that up. But anyway, so that's a lot of money when different assets trade on momentum and strength begets strength. And if gold was missing that bid because people, this whole new generation, was throwing their money into cryptocurrencies as their hedge against the stewardship of fiat currencies, that mattered a lot, I think. But I don't know that that's the reason why it underperformed for so long, but I have to come up with something, and that's all the what's your answer?
That's a thesis that is worth considering. It's non-falsifiable, which are always the best kind.
I love that, yeah.
During COVID, it can't explain the kind of pre-crypto lagging period for gold, where it peaked and it went from 1900 to 1100. Now, there was still Bitcoin then, but it wasn't a real player for the last couple of years. And and this is totally anecdotal, so I don't have any studies behind it. Certainly analysis of flows, which is what would matter to your point. But just sociologically, I've talked to very few people that were big gold guys that are now big crypto guys. They're out there and they're kind of older and a little nerdier, and they've always been sort of, you know, newsletter readers and that kind. But most of the crypto people I meet are younger and hipper, and they're more tech oriented.
Like me, right?
Yeah, like you, right? And so I don't take them as former gold guys. That's just my anecdotal read on the sociology of it.
No, that makes sense. And I'm scratching my head trying to figure out a reason why it's underperformed the way it has too. So that makes sense to me. And I guess the end of that answer is I don't know. But it has had historically been an asset that's sluggish. And then when you need it, you need it. Then when it starts to move, it starts to move. And I'm waiting for that to happen. I don't know if I was going to say I'm hoping for that to happen. I don't know. I'm not. When I'm short the market is not as much fun as being long the market.
Yeah.
I prefer making money when other people make money.
But are you short the market with some long positions for alpha, or are you totally defensive?
Question. Right now? No. I actively trade like four different accounts and on different time frames. I'm short the market in my short term futures account, and even within that, I have some option positions. Like just before I got on with you, the market was 10 minutes from closing in this just horrendous day. I bought a call fly in the NASDAQ, an aggressive call fly to hedge some of my shorts.
Okay.
And so I don't, again, I am a risk mitigator at heart. So I don't just load the boat and say, I want all these puts, give me them all, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. That's not the way I trade.
So you know you have a bearish bias when we're referring to buying a call to hedge.
Exactly, right, you know. Exactly, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me leave us with something a bit less market and investment and trade-oriented and a little more philosophical. The purpose of this podcast is to defend free enterprise and to defend capital markets, which I view as vital to a healthy free enterprise system. And it is not to do so because AOC and Bernie are going to take us down, although they are stated enemies of a free enterprise ideology. I believe National Review and what I'm trying to do with my message is make for smarter defenders of free enterprise inside the camp of people that are already pretty pro-free enterprise, but just need a little bit more understanding and foundational truth. Because right now I see a lot of people on the right getting pulled around, you know, hey, it's not a free society I'm advocating for. It's a big state that will do the things I want it to do. And we see this in some of the big tech conversations, and we you know, there's a certain sense that populism can go that way at times. Do you think free enterprise is safe in American society?
No, I don't. I think that it's under success. I'm in a state, so are you, you're in California, but I'm in a state that seems to put you in the crosshairs. If they feel that you're successful and been a good entrepreneur, it seems the relationship between government and the restaurant industry seems like they believe that every restaurant somehow is hiding buckets of cash somewhere. They're going to come after them. I think that we're at a spot, and I don't think they're going to win. I think free enterprise is going to win. But you asked the question, if I think it's under attack, I think that's the way you phrased it. And yeah. I think it is absolutely under attack. And I know over the last 5, 6, 7 years, if I'm going to have a voice and I'm going to be able to speak on this, I'm going to speak about it as loudly and as vociferously as I can, that we need, you mentioned before, like, crap like the zombie companies, that the success is punished and yet zombie companies are kept alive instead of the invisible hand coming and wiping them out and replacing them with innovation. I think we're at a really bad spot for capitalism right now, and we have to keep pushing it. And I think part of it is for being conservatives too, from a political standpoint, the environment and regulation. I'm pro those things. Conservatives should be able to take that. Yeah. That plank, and conservation is right there. Go to a Ducks Unlimited meeting if you ever think that conservatives aren't environmental people. I do think there should be environmental regulations. And I do think, of course, there should be safety regulations. But I think that we have to be able to take the shackles off the corporate sector and let people make some money and celebrate it when they do.
Yeah. I agree 100%. You know, one of the reasons I titled my recent book on economics, There's No Free Lunch, is that Milton Friedman's point about life being, and particularly a study of economics, being about trade-offs, trade-offs that exist because of the reality of scarcity. I think we need conservative free marketeers to be grown-ups and acknowledge trade-offs. And so to say, we do want environmental regulations, but we want them to be understood as to what the give and take is, what the cost and benefits are going to be, and apply that to these different elements. I also don't feel the need to defend tax cuts all the time as always revenue generative on the supply side, the kind of Laffer's curve thing. Sometimes I believe in a tax cut because I think the government's extracting too much money from the private sector, and there needs to be less money to Treasury, and there needs to be a lesser size of government.
Yeah, you know, they do dumb things with their money oftentimes.
They're not great allocators of capital, I've noticed.
Terrible. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. Well, you know, between New York, California, Illinois, we're gluttons for punishment in these blue states. But I'll tell you, I still love these states and I still love this country. And maybe you and I can just keep doing our thing. And if we ever get to down and out about it, I'll come grab a ginger ale at your pub and we'll talk more.
No doubt about it. A burger, too. You didn't give up burgers, not everything.
No. That's part of my deal. I'm not getting rid of caffeine and I'm not getting rid of food. And if the doctor did say you have got to stop eating steak and burgers, I would just, you know, or you're going to die. You know, I was going to say this earlier when you said you come to my pub four nights a week and you're going to die. You know who else is going to die? People who don't go to your pub four nights a week.
Exactly, yes. Amen to that.
All right, my friend. Hey, Jim, we got to do this again, okay?
That was fun. Thank you very much, David. Have a good night.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciate you listening to Capital Record. You know, you could probably tell there wasn't a lot Jim and I disagreed on there, and the reason for that is not because we feel the need to sit there and force each other to agree with one another. We happen to be two peas in a pod, and there's different ways we do things in our own stewardship of capital. But obviously worldview and basic perspective and thought, there's a lot of overlap. And when you're looking at the economy, when you're looking at the Fed, when you're looking at where we are right now in the political landscape, I hope you got some nuggets today out of what Jim had to share. I know I did, and I would love to have him back. And I'd love to have you back listening to Capital Record. Please share the podcast with anyone you'd like. Put it up on your social media. Subscribe, review us, do all the things that help us grow and scale what's going on. We continue to grow our loyal listenership, and we appreciate that, but we do want the biggest audience possible so we can share a message that will help promote the defense of a free and virtuous society. Thank you for listening to the Capital Record.